Vernal Bogren Swift, and the presentation is Energy Patterns as Visualization. And I'm going to read this because I don't know how it is for you, but to stay on the mark of what I want to talk about when I'm talking about an idea, I have to write it out or I have to know it really well. And so I want to stay on the mark with you with this. And I want to invite you to ask questions as we go along. It would be helpful. I find it an essentially uncomfortable position to be only presenting. It's much more desirable to have dialogue. And we can stay on the mark of that. I'll tell you what I'm going to talk about today, and then I'll begin that talk. See, I really believe that energy is demonstrated visually. I don't think that we know how to see this. And I think that that's because we haven't had the orientation to do that. We haven't been raised to see dance of light or to see dance of energy. We've been raised to see things more discreetly than universally. I think that if we had been taught this, then we'd notice our lives in an entirely different light. And so this is what I want to talk about. I want to tell you just the tiniest bit of what I've learned about how some people in other countries view their world in terms of energy patterns. And I'll do this through a little bit of discussion of their art and how that art is different from ours here in the U.S. And then I'll speak of energy as visual pattern from my own experience. And I think I can do that best showing you slides of work I've done this past year. And then I want to talk with you, if you will, about the difference between looking at the world through the eyes of Descartes and breaking down things into their logical components, and comparing that with this alternative way of seeing energy as form, as seeing energy as form, as seeing the negative space in the world. And that, of course, is the way of the metaphor, of the fairy tale, of mythology, religion, and of dream. So to start, I want to make it clear what I'm talking about by giving you a couple of pictures, not yours for one. Can you all see this board pretty well from where you are? Can you see the steam rising off my hand as I do that? Mm-hmm. Raised another way, you might. Okay, I want to give a butchering lesson. I've been working in the kitchen, you know, and so I have to start off with a butchering lesson. You know what this is? What is this? Huh?
It's a piggy.
It's a piggy. And if we were to break apart this pig in terms of butchering it, we would divide it relative to its value to us, right? So that the hams would go in one place and the ham hocks in another, and the ribs and the shanks and whatever else, we would define that pig all over the place. And then when we went to butcher it, we would separate out its parts. We would take it apart in that way. This is my very good marker. And we would do that because we would say that, well, some parts are more valuable and they're more tasty, and we want to show it that way. If you lived in PNG, and you were Papua New Guinea, and you wanted to butcher a pig, you would do it quite a different way. Kind of skinny pigs, it's like. And that would be the front. This would be the front of it with its snout split both ways. And this would be the back of it with, of course, its hands and legs like this. Now, the reason that it wouldn't be measured off in terms of its parts and its components would be that the values in Papua New Guinea are really different. And there is a specialness about twinning, something that makes it more wonderful. And the other thing is that if you're going to serve a lot of guests and you want each one to feel special, then you're going to serve pig. You're not going to serve ham and head cheese and bacon and sow belly, right? And so the pig is split not this way to open it up, but right down this way and taken apart, so there's two pigs. When you treat your world differently, you think differently about it. If someone in the U.S. were to draw a pregnant woman, then I think you'd recognize that this is pretty much the way it would look. You agree? Sort of. As a cartoon, we say that's a pregnant woman. In Papua New Guinea, a pregnant woman would look a lot like this. In terms of a drawing, you understand? Let's see. Hard to draw this because it's not my way of drawing. And if we were drawing a pregnant woman from the Haida Indian mentality of British Columbia, we might do it this way. Now, what's the point here? Is that I'm suggesting, and it's certainly not true entirely, but it is generally true, that in the United States, we have been taught to view a thing as we see it, and we draw the outlines of it. We draw the surface of it, and we settle for that. In Papua New Guinea, people view themselves as creatures, and they are animistic. And so the representation of themselves is a lot like the representation of any meat cut open. Furthermore, they have a sense of X-ray. They don't see things just for the outside shape of it, but rather sense the dynamics and the energy within something. And so they have to show what's going on. In British Columbia, pregnancy can be viewed as totem, so that a female will come from a place, and her place may be the Bear Clan or the Eagle Clan or whatever her clan is, and her most truest sense is not her nice brown eyes or her long hair, but rather her totem, her eagleness or her bearness, or forgive the pun, or whatever, so that pregnant woman of the Bear Clan will be represented as her totem, with the evidence of her pregnancy demonstrated in a smaller totem of what she's going to bear. Does this not change around the way a person views the world? You know, to see things in terms of an inner vitality or of a community or a totemic vitality, it makes a different kind of sense of structure. So, now to switch back to Holden, I said that I wanted to discuss energy as visualization, and the objective of doing so is that as creative persons, we want to have all the tools at hand for using our imagination, for breaking free of just the systemic, logical way that you can bet your boots, we have been taught to imitate, and it's very hard to break free of it. I think that I never even thought about how I was drawing and representing my own life force as an artist until I was in Papua New Guinea. And this was many years from the time I had begun working. And I set out to try actually to reproduce some of the ways of structuring of that I saw. And so I had been asked to make a piece for a church of a Madonna and Child, because I'd made a very successful one for a church in Minneapolis, you know, imitating the 13th century Russian Orthodox Madonnas and Child. And so I had a very large piece of fabric, and I started to draw loosely out the side of my ears, not thinking, and slipped into the ability to draw the vitality of a thing, and became so dizzy that I had to stop. I thought later that I became so dizzy because I had probably fallen into my subconscious or into my unconscious. We're so used in our culture to staying in our logical, conscious space that to get out of it can be a stunning experience unless we're asleep, right? Or does that alter when you're playing music or something? Do you know?
Sometimes.
And then what happens?
I just don't notice what I'm doing.
Uh-huh, exactly.
I don't get dizzy, but it's a different place.
And you could understand how one might be dizzy if you're using your eyes, you know, that you could become dizzy. Because it is a different place, and it's not exactly down, but it's definitely horizontal or something. So to be back in the village and to make this a little stronger lesson on changing thinking about vitality, imagine the electrical system here and the fact that it comes from water. And let's just pretend for a moment that none of us knows anything about electricity. For me, that isn't difficult at all. But imagine that you don't know anything about electricity. Imagine that you don't know anything about hydropower either, that you know about how they happen. Imagine that you know you can observe that there are some moons or suns around on the ceiling up here. And did you ever consider why we make light bulbs and light sources round? That maybe there is something in us that wants to unconsciously reproduce the shape of light sources. But anyway, imagine that only what you see is the light here, but you've been given the task of defending how it is, defending the argument that water is responsible for this energy pattern. Can you do it? Well, does logic tell you that water has made this energy pattern?
My imagination could, if I let go long enough.
Well, and what? How would you do that?
Well, I would just start to come up with all sorts of possibilities as to how it might be. Nothing rooted in any sort of scientific reasoning. I would just start to put some ideas together, which, taken to a very full extent, might produce light.
Could you do that now, Tom, for fun?
That there's actually a hose that comes from the ceiling in which water is piped through it, and somehow the water crashes into the bulb and produces light.
Yeah, or like how it is on sea surf, at really strong sea surf at night, even though it's dark as anything, how the foam on top of very energetic waves stays white, mm-hmm. That maybe some of that somehow has been put here, or maybe there's some phosphorescence that is brought from water to here, you know, that stays alive by agitating it continuously, you know. You're relying on your imagination, and so am I, but really we're relying on what we've seen of real life. Why do we rely on that rather than on, I mean, doesn't anybody here know how electricity works?
Are you serious?
I'm serious.
Tom does.
Yes.
I know how electricity works, because one time Kirk, when he was small, took a hairpin and put it in the wall outlet, and it produced light.
Among other things.
Besides burning his fingers, he also produced light.
Well, of course, you know, it's evident that we can look to the abstraction, we can look to the books for the formula to understand what electricity is, but in order to experience electricity and in order to find the language and therefore the music or the visualization of it, we have to go from an experiential position, a vision position of what electricity is. And that's a wonderful proposition when, in fact, here it's come from water. You know, it's come from such a magical thing, you know, to such confinement. And yet we don't do it. I think it's like when I get on a plane and we're ready for takeoff, and I'm looking out the window and I can hardly suppress my desire to go meh, meh, because I don't know how to fly. I know how to walk, how to run. I know how to swim. I know a little bit about driving, but I don't know how to fly, and yet I'm drinking a martini, you know, as if I'm a sophisticated person, as if I am a worldly educated person who is, in fact, you know, out of experience. And when we're out of experience, I don't think we can be creative people. I don't know how that is for you. I don't know how to fly, so when I'm on the airplane, all I can do is drink. And being out of experience means that I cannot find a metaphor for flying other than swimming, because I don't know how. And if we don't have the language for our creative images or writing or music, we can't do it. And that's why, you know, that's why travel and experience and relationships are so enriching to one's creative soul, is that we understand. And I'm suggesting once again that we're limited in that because of how we've been taught to see things. And that's because we have a Cartesian model, and we're going to talk about that in a minute. But first, I want to show you my slides.
Are you saying that you have to be able to talk about it in order
to do it? You don't have to be able to talk about it, but you have to be able to make, you have to, I'm suggesting that I have to have an experience of it either in song or movement or some way in order to do anything with it. An idea isn't an idea if it can't, it can be a sensation. We can have a feeling of excitement or a feeling of fear, but an idea, a thought process that wants to become something tangible in song, word, or whatever, I propose can't happen without an experience of that, not direct, but an understanding of an experience. As Tom said, to be willing to find the language to explain these bumpy bright spots.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I have it right here.
This last year I've been doing work related to this idea of visualizing energy. Trying to be aware of energy when I come across it. For instance, this first happened to me, I think, when I was in Africa or some hot place, and I was on a veranda looking into a shimmering green canopy of leaves, and I was sleepy and I was daydreaming, and all of a sudden became aware that I wasn't any longer seeing the green discrete forms of the leaves, but was seeing the bright light form shimmering between them. And that was not anything particular. I just switched into the negative space and realized that people in hot, bright countries probably see light configuration as readily as they see discrete shape configuration because of the intensity of it, but also recognized in that I was looking at the very patterns that I had seen on objects in the marketplace. And I realized then intuitively that these persons were drawing what they saw, and they were seeing exactly the opposite of what I was seeing. If you look at art from some parts of Africa, and certainly from Papua New Guinea, the art is called hapnik, and it's art that is surrounded by really busy signs of, well, literally things like this. And our art therapy books call it hapnik art, which is essentially can be taken as a derogatory term to mean schizophrenic, because it just isn't the way we do it. Okay. So when I was in Nepal, can you see it? When I was in Nepal, I was followed by beggars, and I felt so discouraged and frightened by them. I could feel the energy of their silent demands of me, which was the energy field, that I had to run away. So when I make a picture of it, I'm trying to show that form, that energy pattern. This is a quilt. My medium is batik. Kafka said, art is the axe that breaks the ice of the imagination. And so this is a memory quilt in which a person at the top with an axe is chopping through ice in her dreams, and large lampreys come forming. Fish under ice are always extremely thirsty for oxygen. And if you break a hole in the ice, you know, at the right season, if they've been in a hard winter and too long underwater, they will flood to the oxygen source and literally mass there. And I wanted to show that sometimes in unmasking the imagination, you can get more than you bargained for because of that deprivation, that hunger of the images of the imagination to break through, knocking the dreamer on her ass. Is that sharp? Yeah.
It was sharp. Yeah.
It goes. There. Frost is the zipper that holds the code of winter shut. I fell cross-country skiing, and being down on the ground, I saw how the fractals of the frost were literally joined together from the sky to the ground, and had the intuition that the frost was literally holding winter together, holding the gray sky to the white ground. Another example of seeing the energy pattern and then trying to make that. This is just for funnies. This is a hammerhead shark woman and shark sister luring moon down with a reflection of itself so that they can eat it. Because they're little devils, they are.
Yeah. Are those, is that from folk tales or mythologies, or is this?
This is my mythology. They're my energy fields. But Verlant, look at, he's right into the trees, that little guy up there. I guess, can we get it any smaller? Okay, good. Yeah. This one is from a detail from a piece from a Papua New Guinea story about a boy who wanted the moon so badly that he kept crying for it, and so his mother took him out and threw him at it. And I think it's a wonderful story of the frustration of being a mother. And it's an energy pattern too, you know, that dialogue, that tension between mother and child until finally there's the release of, go to your room. And another tension picture, this is from, this is related to the memories. Is that the way you pronounce it, George?
Yeah.
The memories, shards of pottery, which related to a story that I had heard once about two boys who asked their grandmother for food three times, and each time she said, no, I can't do it, I'm too busy. And so the third time, they knocked her door down and turned her into a shark, the first shark, the mother shark. The sea is full of female images, incidentally. Sedna, the sharks, the sirens, all the sea belongs to women. It's a wonderful, wet, fertile place. And anyway, she becomes the first shark, and as such then, she didn't feed them, but now they feed her. There is an idea in Haida Indian belief that says, and we were talking about this for long, that says, don't look back and don't regret the past and don't look back and just do what you need to do. And this then is a story about that, of how if you come to water, just get in and swim. But in the swimming, it will change you. And you cannot get out of that water again in the form that you entered. You cannot. The struggle of the swim will change you. This is an energy pattern from the... what's his name? Arthur at Avalon. Arthur's sister, Morgan, you know, is the person who came to save him. And I knew that Arthur was probably dead, and in trying to resurrect him, the only way I could do that was to have his half-sister, Morgan, free him with the fishes from the net of death that was binding them. And because he's been in water so long, he can only come back to life again as the moon. I think he rises with his swamped boat each night as moon. And what I'm showing you is what I have done with work myself since deciding not to see my life literally, but to see my life and the relationships and the things that happen in it as what I might have been afraid a crazy person would do in an earlier time. To try to see the dynamic of tension, positive and neutral and negative tension between things, and to catch hold of that, and to try to show what would that look like. This is a piece called Moving Day. And on Moving Day, established pattern begins to break up and alter, even as new pattern that at first appears to be chaos because it isn't familiar yet, is forming itself in the background. And what once held water no longer does. And this is detail from, when I was in Alaska, there were these wonderful dogs. The Bethel, Alaska is filled with dog lots, and they set up little volleys of barking at night in these short summer nights when the moon comes out. And I thought, what is the energy? What is the relationship? They see the moon, which is, it's a short night, and they're excited. What is the story? And I realized that these dogs are used to long winter nights when they run with the moon. They're on dog sleds and they can run and run. And it seems to me that these are dogs who are out of pattern in the summertime. They see the moon and they're chained to their dog houses so that they are energy out of season. So lastly, let's bring up this issue of how we say what we see. You know, Descartes founded analytical geometry, and you know he's our man of reason. He believed thought to be the very, very essence of being a man. And he said, nothing is included in the concept of body that belongs to the mind, and there is nothing in the concept of the mind that belongs to the body. They are separate. And I think that that basic reductionism, that separateness, is what we see when we separate out one body from the others, and we cannot see systems or universes, or even when I was showing you, you know, the picture of the creature that we butcher and we say parts is parts. Well, we laugh about that parts is parts, but we operate like that because I propose that Descartes taught us, or taught our teachers to teach us, that a thing is best understood to have a concept and then to take it apart into its parts and put it back together again in a more logical way so that we can get on with our lives, right? Do you agree?
Yes.
Okay. I don't know, though, I hadn't known that, do you know that this fellow was 23 when he got this idea, and he had an intuition that he could devise a science based on symbols that would be truth. He felt that that this was something that God would give him. And this belief was verified, this intuition was verified by a dream he had, in which the dream gave him symbolic forms, meaning his analytical geometry, to put together his science of the way to tell truth. And I think it's so wonderful that he, like many scientific figures, gained their vision through their intuition and their dream and through a sense of the rightness to pursue that and to make it hold together better. You know, what about all the scientists that we have read about who had perfectly beautiful, creative, artistic ideas that didn't hold up scientifically, but are valued as just gorgeous ideas? Wasn't it Kepler who wrote and believed that the planets make music because of their size and the way they come together and just the harmony, and because music is the nicest thing, and so why wouldn't the universe want to sing? And yet Kepler is a scientist. I don't know what we know him for now. Do you? I know him for that absurdity. What is he known in the science world for? Huh? Oh. Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Isn't it wonderful that he extrapolated so beautifully? It's the extrapolation where the potential is. And wrapping this up, I think that we might not have been so parts as parts oriented in our thinking if Descartes had not come along when he did, but that our time and our culture was looking for just this kind of backup because of the place in time where we were, which is the industrial pickup. And of course then Darwin picks up on this and says, you know, a nice big head is a real sign of intelligence, and Freud comes along and says, we can explain everything. And the timing was just good for it. We may have gone somewhere, you know, completely different. And it's still not too late. our philosophy wanted to see energy patterns caught and held abstractly, caught and held secretly, caught and held thoughtfully and intelligently, instead of open to extrapolation, open to discussion, in the way that we once sat under stars and said, see that little group up there, what are they doing anyway? And we have all the stories in all the cultures about the Pleiades and all these, because there was time to extrapolate about energy forms. Is one better than the other? I don't think so, but I can tell you that for me, I don't want to settle for logical thinking. I don't want to settle for that. I want to have enough of that to get along for the times when I need it, and for credibility. We all have to look sane. But but I want to get on with outlandish, wild thinking. And I want to encourage other creative folks to do the same, because it's certainly available to us. It's just that we've been raised kind of funny and stiffly. And I want to close with just one last little story about visual energy. This last summer, Eric and I had the good luck to spend a week working on a research project with ancient murrelets. These are seabirds that live 11 months pelagically, about 5 miles out from land. And for 1 month of the year, they come in to very high mountains. Well, I say they're very high mountains because I'm afraid of height. But they come in and they nest at they nest up high, steep inclines under the roots of trees in burrows about 3 feet deep. Then the parents go back to the water when the chicks are hatched, and the chick is hatched with legs that are full size, so that you have this little thing the size of a mouse on these little, on full-size bird legs. And the adults go down to the water and they start calling up, "It's time to get down here, come home, come home." There's no food in the burrow, and there are rats and other animals on the island that can kill these little tiny fuzzies. And this is in British Columbia. And they have got approximately 20 hours, but they're supposed to do the run at night, and it's a summer night. They have to leave their 3-foot burrow and run like hell all the way down the hill and get back to the water before they can have their first meal. They only,
This is at night.
At night.
And they follow the light of the sea.
And they follow the light of the sea. Or they'd follow the light of your flashlight if you wanted to trick them, you know. They follow light, and they have only enough energy in them. Their little energy pattern is such that they've only got enough to get home. And it is a real, when we were working with them, I kept feeling my heart breaking open, you know, and thinking, oh God, why would you make such an irony? What is the story? And my mind flew to the carnival stilt walkers. Have you ever seen pictures or seen the stilt walkers at carnival? Do you know how they are? They're on very tall stilts, and how they totter down the street, you know, like this. And we see them, or we see pictures of them, and something rotates in our heads and we say, there's something godly going on here. I think what the godliness going on there is that we ourselves are stilt walkers, and we have to come out of the darkness of where we begin and walk on unsteady, long legs into the future, and we don't even know why, but we've got just enough energy to get it done. And that's that. I'm finished.
Thanks, Bruno.
Does this call up anything in this creative community?
One thing that run with me was that we're talking about Cartesian model of the world, and how much we've embraced that, and how far it's taken us, but how much damage it's done, and us individually as a culture and a civilization, and how we need to look at the other side and become more balanced with it.
Yes, and the trick is that we can't even look at it, right? It's something that lives outside it's something that lives about getting the brainstem.
Yeah.
So it can't even be looked at, it has to be laughed at.
Yeah, I don't know how to do that. Yeah.
Thanks for that. Anything else? Do you know how to do that? Do you do it, George? When you're working, do you get hold of the
right brain? That's right. Right brain.
Are you playing parts as parts and calling us left and right brained?
Well, that's the way I can relate.
That's the way we've been taught it, too. And I suggest that it's not anywhere in here. It's out here. It's all out here. and that it's in sleep, mythology, religion, good luck, and for myself, travel, and music shoots it in at us. You know, it's not like we are the operant. We are not the operants in this. We are the solvents, or the solutes, or whatever it would be. We are attacked by the experience, and then we can interpret and extrapolate on it, and maybe turn it back into another visual or musical or other creative actuality. So I say, you know, hold yourself open to attack. And lastly, what was this? I had something. To suspend belief is to make it fly. There.
Okay.
It ruined me.
It ruined me because you weren't in this nice, convenient, explained box.
Broke me up. Mm-hmm.
Is that frightening?
Not anymore. It's a real delight now. But I think that you know, we all have experiences of being broken, and travel and experience broke me.
Yeah.
I don't know. Religion's not nice and easy anymore. I miss that.
But you've also experienced the fear of that time in the snow.
Yeah. Yeah, naturally. If part of the reason, Guy is always saying, let me take you up here on the scarp because there's real joy to be seen up there. And I can't go up with him because I'm afraid of physical things. I'm afraid of being hurt, slipping, falling, breaking, you know, whatever. I make most of my travels inside my head because I'm not afraid of the travel there, because I know how to get back again safely. But I have noted that just as I'm afraid to do physical travel, you know, to hike or something, I've known many people who are afraid to do psychological travel or inside head travel for fear of being hurt. And it is true, as the physical traveler will say, and as the psychological traveler will say, you really can get hurt, but probably not.
Book that I happened to be reading, and it was talking about tribalism, and the author was saying that the more sophisticated we get, the more we try to control the senses. But her experience that tribes are a lot more, we look at tribalism as a lot smaller, but actually on the senses they're a lot more wide open.
Yes.
And, you know, just in terms of their sexuality, in terms of their expressions, in terms of their art, they're just a lot more.
Yes. Active. And I think that the drawings are like that too, you know, as to go, you know, split open this way. Just fully available. It's true.
I'm really interested in how different cultures perceive the body and the processes of the body, physiology, and, you know, we tend in our culture to talk about the body in terms of plumbing, with pipe and bowel, or in terms of a machine
yes.
imagery. And many other cultures have this much more wide-open, many more open images, and the images, like you were saying, come from out here. You know, they have relationships with the entire universe, and they see their body as sort of an exchange of fluids and gases with the entire universe. And I think that is such a profound statement about how different we are, culture to culture, and how that very basic thing, how I perceive the way I am designed and the way I work, must affect every single other relationship we have with.
Yes, I think that's an excellent point. And happily, each of us comes from a culture that at one point was richly imbued with its mythology, religion, stories, and fairy tales. Each of us has a history that relates to this, and we can find it. Mm-hmm. And then you know, it's the same that, you know, if you, whatever you're doing a lot of, you begin to think like that more and more, so that I think that one way to find this openness is to go back to our own histories in our mythology, in our particular Celtic or whatever mythology, and really listen to it. I think it's wonderful that in the Christmas celebrations we sang of angels all the time. I mean, there were Hark the Little Herald Angels singing, and there were angels we've heard on high. I mean, the place was covered with angels. We were singing about Jesus with his pinions. We were singing about feathered creatures all the time, singing right along, hitting all the notes right. And because I love angels, I could see them all flying around here, do you know? And it was really wonderful because we called them into being. We called them into being in singing. The words that we use, you know, when you name something, you've called it up. Eskimos in childbearing call out names until the baby responds to the right name, because a word is really important. The word calls up something. So when we were singing our wonderful angel songs, you know, didn't we call up the angels? And I think that mythology is present all through. It's just that we're not seeing it anymore. We don't even see those words. They're invisible to us now as a reality. We don't even think about it. It's like the electricity. We say, we're flying now. Don't glob on. But we still have it. This is just a temporary disorder. And we can reclaim it because we still have it. It's nothing lost. It's temporarily disordered.
And it's maybe as simple as realizing the way that I see things may not be the way that you see things. You know?
That's right. It won't be.
But I think even that is something that
yes. You're outside a lot. And so you will be thinking, I would suspect, kinesthetically, that you will see something and you may not have thought about it enough to form the patterns of it, but I would suggest that you think in movement because you're outdoors moving a lot. You know, not everyone... We are what our experience is. We are not bigger than what we're doing. We are a reflection of what we're doing. Well, should we go home and have dinner? That was fun. Thank you. Thank you for coming. I think it's really important that you're willing to support me, and I'm willing to support you. Creativity is fragile, and it has to have support, real support. And so you have made me stronger as an artist by coming to take time with me, and I'd like to do that back with you if and how you need and want that too, because it's a fragile community. The creative community is fragile.